I remember you said it a long time ago, and I don't know if you still agree with it, is that there are many different points of view on this subject, and the subject is whether there will always be the more evolved, let's call it that, and the less evolved and the medium evolved, and we need everybody to evolve to create the world we live in, so
All right,
that
yeah.
we need people who are completely idiotic, who have, maybe dogs are more intelligent than them, or other animals are more intelligent than certain humans, which I think is true.
Yeah.
And is that necessary in order that the more intelligent can exist? So
Right.
this is this, that can only exist because everything else exists. So this whole notional opposites of love exists because hate exists, and so on.
Yeah, I think
So
it's
that.
interesting that you bring that up because yeah, we sort of discussed it and obviously it's sort of developed in both of our minds since that time when we discussed it probably I don't know 10 years ago or something maybe, but I still give that kind of thought as an example. But the way I would put it these days was probably something like every group needs a variety, and it's just as simple as if something came along that wiped out all the frogs. For some reason, some of the frogs were resistant to whatever it is that killed the rest, and that kept them going. And that's why you have a variety, and that's why some are more violent, some are less violent, some are more, bigger and smaller, and all that stuff. And I suppose there's probably a word for it, like genetic variance, or there's like probably some sort of biological explanations for that kind of stuff within, well, within biology. But I think yeah, it applies to mindsets as well, and to yeah, I think maybe the point I used to make a lot was something like we need the people who don't think differently so that it gives space for those of us who do, I suppose, something like that,
Well, it certainly, if I ever read a paper, it makes me so angry sometimes that I then I'm motivated to think in a different way. At the same time, I think that is it possible that if I was more evolved, I wouldn't even be affected by it. So it's like,
Could you be a bit more specific on that? I
Yeah,
didn't quite follow.
I'm trying to, I'm trying. There's a point I'm trying to make that I can't really find at the moment. It's like, it's about this, there being there. Ultimately, when I come down to all of it, it's about everybody has, whether it's completely unconscious or they have actually explicitly worked on it, have an understanding or a view upon what is a human being and what is the universe. The vast majority of people have never thought about it.
Yeah,
But
that's
you and
correct.
I think about it nearly all the time. So that's the first thing that I think. Why is it that I, in my daily experience, when I'm awake, moving around, and even when I'm asleep, I'm going consciously into my sleep thinking, okay, something's might happen tonight that. So I'm conscious nearly all the time. There's the moments when I fall asleep, when I kind of stub my toe, when I do stupid things, great. But it's that's where I'm at. And when I then meet anybody, and the vast majority of people I meet have never thought about much, and they are to a certain extent robots programmed by their upbringing and so on and so forth, there's a chink of consciousness there saying, hey, my God, I just said that. That's bizarre. But that's so rare. And when I meet those people, it's really easy to get on with them, and there's no sense of competition. None. None. And yet, why is it, why is that, first of all? And that's one thing. And then the second thing is, when I think of this guy Gurdjieff, who existed a long time ago, who talked about this very thing. He was an Armenian guy, an esoteric guy, and he said he thinks that there's only, I think he said about 200 people in the entire planet that are really serious about consciousness and being aware and developing, consciously developing themselves as, you know, realizing that I am the work. You know, it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point of being alive.
The point of being alive is I am the work. Nothing else. It's who I am. Learning more conscious of what is that? Why am I doing that? And that then leads to other things. So any work. Yeah, sorry, I'll stop.
Are you asking so that I can?
Yeah, yeah, I am. What is the question?
So as far as I understand, the first question was, why do we have people who are on one hand highly reflective and conscious of their consciousness, and the other majority seems to be very unconscious of their conscious facilities, you could say. And then the other thing was that it was suggested sort of some time ago that there were lots of people who were, I mean, sorry, that there were very few people who were actually actively conscious. And perhaps the answers to both are sort of rolled into one. So I'll just try and answer in general what I think about it, like when you suggest, like, why. And it just seems to me like people are, we're kind of brought up not to think too much, and it used to be something that was owned by you know, the religious or the educated or the upper class, the elite. You know, we were the peasants basically, who, you know, we only really existed to toil the fields and all that sort of thing. And the idea of us reading was already, you know, sort of a bit taboo, because then we wouldn't be able to be manipulated. And in a very basic sense, that kind of feudal stuff, I mean, that was how we lived for a long time. That was a stage in evolution of our civilization, which worked for us. Well, it worked for the king very well, at least, and for the lords and everyone. It didn't seem to work so well for the peasants, but that's from our perspective nowadays, where we've reached a point where we realize that all of us can have kind of equality to some extent. But then you kind of sort of, I think those of us who've had enough experience to be able to be kicked out of the safety of the standard sort of upbringing, like, so have two kids, go to school, do really well. For whatever reason, it tends to, from my experience at least, it tends to be people who've somehow had traumas or, well, there are different reasons that you kind of fall off the boat, and then you suddenly realize, oh, hang on a minute, it's just a boat. And that, maybe if some people it's psychedelics, some people it's kind of, you know, I don't know, there's lots of different ways that you can get triggered to suddenly think, hang on a minute, what if I was to think differently about something? And, you know, I don't know. Personally, I grew up always like that, and it's in my blood. So I don't know.
I'm also the same. But then I think, well, you know, I can't actually not think like this anymore. So and also that somehow something triggers a process that you can't stop. It's just unstoppable. Sorry, hang on a second. I'm being shouted at.
Sure.
Hello. Now. Okay, we'll have to pause this.
Okay.
I don't know if I actually can. I don't think I can pause recording. Can I? Hang on. Yep. Okay. Recording again.
Cool. So, and then the other thought. I mean, the idea of this guy saying that there was like 200 people around. I mean, it sort of rolls in because, like, I think what you know, the Matrix, that movie, and I know that. Mm-hmm. You know, in a lot of ways, it's kind of a cheesy movie and all that. But there's quite a lot of reference, I think, to this idea that, you know, you kind of you're ignorant and you're in a, you know, Garden of Eden. Well, in fact, let's face it, the Bible also talks about it. And then something comes along and makes you sort of aware that you're naked and aware that you're ignorant actually, and that, you know, you go on this journey of sort of trying to discover what things actually mean and what, you know, what actually things are, and taking on a new level of observation and, you know, reflection and things like that, which, you know, maybe that's the kind of golden trick, you know, because I agree that what you said about, like, how, you know, it's like your life's work, isn't it, to explore
what well, the it thing, is the thing, human. There's an anecdote from, so he worked with a guy called Aspensky, and Aspensky was much better at writing about Gurdjieff's ideas than Gurdjieff was, and well, it's my opinion. I just think he was. Well, Gurdjieff would probably say he had a specific intention the way he wrote, which is very unusual and odd. Which was the whole point was to kind of constantly shock you out of your current way of thinking.
Right.
And Aspensky was more traditional, trying to explain stuff in a certain way,
make it more accessible. Maybe.
Yeah, more accessible to what actually is this about? And there was a very I always remember this anecdote was when they were somewhere in Russia, and there was a whole group of them, and then they invited these academics to their dinner, and Gurdjieff said, "Hey, you know, these guys are not conscious," and others were saying, "No, no, give them a chance, you'll see." And they came, and Gurdjieff basically just played them, and Uspensky wrote that, yeah, they all realized very, very quickly that these academics, they just speak and talk from memory. They have got no awareness of what they're talking about. They've got no awareness of what's going around them. They don't know what's going on. They don't understand the situation. They don't understand the relationship between the people that are there. It's just all just going blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and it's like monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah, monkey see, monkey do. And it's hard for academics, I think, because in general, and I'm not talking about, you know, every academic, because I know many academics who are highly conscious.
This is the old academic we're talking
about.
Yeah,
the old academic. Or the but there are, it's relative, because I think I've met academics who are, you know, in fact, if you are still an academic and working in that world, you haven't reached the point where, this is my opinion, if you're an academic and you're still in the system, you haven't reached the point where you can move out of that system and learn how to survive or not survive or struggle with your thinking and ideas. You need the security of that academic system to basically do what? You know, write papers, be forced to write papers, be forced to teach, be forced to research. And they are comfortable in that, and they meet every year. They have congresses, they have conferences, they meet, they chat. It's a system, it's a world, it's a game. And I know a guy, a lovely guy, he's a very sweet guy, he's from Chile, he's a fantastic research scientist in his own world. His entire life is microbiology, and that's it. But you put him out of that context with other people and this, he's fucking abysmal, he's dead. He's not universal, he can only function within a certain area, and therefore his thinking is limited to that world. And I say, well, his thinking ultimately, overall, was limited.
And absolutely.
If he was able to experience other worlds and do other things and meet different people, then
he might get inspired, right?
Exactly. And he might experience and see something in his microbiological work that he would never see if he wasn't. So it's this experts are clouded by their own expertise.
Well, I think it's a topic that's close to my own heart as well, because I grew up, you know, really disillusioned with the education system. And let me just tell you a little example. There's two examples, but I'll just give you one, because it's just, for me, it just accentuates everything about this whole context. When I was 7 or something, I think maybe 8, and I was in first school, as they call it in England. So there was this teacher, and he was actually quite a good teacher, and he was saying, you know, okay, so here's the longest word in the English language without any vowels. And, you know, he wrote rhythm on the board, and I just looked at it, and I thought for a bit, and I was like, I put my hand up, and I said, no, it's not. Because I was a bit cheeky, you know. I could have said, hey, I've got a, you know, new idea. But I was like, no, it's not. Just to embarrass him a little bit. And he's like, yes, it is. I'm like, no, it's not. And then and he's like, look, here it is. And he showed me the book. And I'm like, yeah, but what about rhythms? It took him like a few minutes maybe, or, you know, I don't know. He was in shock basically for a few seconds at least. And the whole class was laughing. But it was, you know, when I look back, I'm like, you know, that really points out the failure of academia in a way, because, you know, I used intelligence, you know, by thinking about it and thinking, well, is that really true or not? I mean, that's what intelligence is. You know, we have a problem. Is this information correct or not? I'm going to think about it for myself. And normally you get kind of punished within academia, or at least at a young age, for doing that. So what they're doing is they're knocking out any kind of thought or consciousness that kids have when interacting with this kind of information. I think it's changing nowadays, but I just wanted to say that, you know, I really have a hard experience with this kind of information.
Well, it's also another example from today, you know, this project involving the wind and wind turbines. It's like, I spoke to a friend of mine today who's a Native American, and she said, you know, I was explaining the complexity of trying to look, you know, where do you place turbine, because wind is not predictable. It's not like water or other forms of energy where you can channel the energy. Wind moves in its own way. You can't predict it. Well, you can try. And so I was describing a valley, and where would you place these things? And if you place them certain ways, maybe that attracts the wind. I mean, who knows? Mm-hmm. And it's always amazing software and physics, whatever, to track. And, you know, you put machines and detectors in the ground. And she said, but why don't you just track the birds? She just said, you know, all these eagles and the birds that fly into that, they understand the wind. That's what they are built to do. They work with the wind. So just put trackers and sensors in the birds and that's it. Hmm. Now, I know a scientist wouldn't, maybe a scientist would have thought of that, but I didn't think of it. And, you know, people involved in that may think, oh, no, you need science, you know, you need different science. So it's like, you know, that came from someone who's got no scientific background at all, who often looks at the sky and the birds and says, well, they obviously understand wind.
And it's interesting because, yeah, people are triggered by what they find familiar. And you know, I was just thinking about that today as well, like in terms of if you grew up playing a flight simulator game and then you're suddenly in a plane and you have to land it, the kid who's played the flight simulator is more likely than people who've never, you know, done that or never flown a plane to actually be able to save the people in the plane. And this kind of idea, it's funny because, like, you know, anyone who claims to be intelligent, like, should realize that, you know, other people have something to offer them. And especially when they don't know. I mean, there's something about not knowing. And like in this example you give, I personally think what's just come up there is like, well, tracking the birds are really difficult. And, you know, couldn't you just rotate the machine based on a little sensor that, you know. And anyway, but that's a different discussion. But the whole idea that you've got a mixed group there and that, you know, I mean, how did those guys react to her when she said that? I mean, did they feel
well? Like she wasn't. She's only spoken to me, and if I present that as an idea, I'm interested to see what they say to think. Even that, you know, rather than using, I think it's anemometers or whatever they're called, you place these things within a landscape, and it can detect where the wind is and where it moves. But then actually, if you just put some sort of tracker on the birds and that goes into that area, you can see that they are more aligned with the wind because they're moving than any object that's stationary. So how can you, okay, they maybe pick up the same information, but it's just an interesting thought. And that it took her like 1 second to offer that.
But I think it might also take 1 second for someone, you know, I mean, I'm quite technically proficient, but like just in my, I'm not an expert, but just in my own head straight away, I'm like, okay, but you know, tracking the birds doesn't necessarily give you the wind direction as well as a little, you know, piece of wood with a rod attached. Do you see what I'm trying to say? And then if the wind's blowing in one direction, this little piece of wood tells you which direction it is. And then the wind turbine is placed in a way that you just have a little rotating funnel on it that sort of points in the direction of the wind. Wow. To get what I'm trying to say? And something like that would be...
Kind of, I'm thinking that, you know, if you've got some sort of tracker on sets of birds, I don't know how it works, but just in my imagination, the birds, when they, if they've got some sort of device attached to their bodies and then they're moving around, you can see through that tracking and in response to the physical landscape, probably in a very different way than you would if you had something that was physically attached to the ground and moving.
Yeah.
Maybe it provides the same information, I don't know. But
interesting. I think it would be much more difficult to get accurate information from birds. But then, anyway, this is a different discussion. But this is where it gets interesting because, you know, somebody can have an idea and say, oh, couldn't you just do that? And it sounds good, but then there's a whole bunch of reasons why it's not actually a good idea. And it's always, you know, I'm not saying that is the case because I don't know. I mean, these engineers might turn around and say, yeah, it sounds good, but it won't work because of this and this and this. And, you know, there's always this practicality between, you know, having that sort of global systems thinking of a particular functionality and being able to throw in ideas. I mean, and the best part for those kind of people like who can think like that is to be able to hear someone like you suggested here, like the could you use the birds? Because then it may be that whether or not using the birds is actually the answer, but it might trigger them in a whole new way that gets them thinking. You know,
it's also more enjoyable as a process because it involves people. Now Becky's interested to see what they say, and then, you know, if she's not an engineer, if the engineers say, hey, thanks for that, it's interesting, then she feels more involved, engaged with the story.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, even if it's not going to provide that much information, you know, I know that even just creating a story around, hey, actually, as an experiment, what we're going to do is track birds and to see if, you know, do birds who understand the wind better than any human does, can they inform us and tell us in certain ways, you know?
Yeah, rather than, I suppose rather though, just to cast a sort of money saving approach on it. There, if somebody was to just to play devil's advocate, if it was a project and I was saying, okay, like someone had an idea, but then I can simulate right away quickly what this means and what kind of information are we trying to get, because it sounds cool, but and I'm not saying this is actually the truth. I'm just throwing it in because you know this kind of stuff costs a lot of money. And it's not worth following just because somebody wants to feel involved. You get what I mean? It may be that if the information necessary is which direction is the wind blowing, so we can turn the turbine into that direction, then it can be much, much simpler than that. But if you're talking about like you know something richer, like yeah, you wanna see the sort of you know where are the best places to place these sort of wind turbines, because you know we know that over say 6 months of wind flow, you know, this area is the strongest and that area is the strongest, then definitely birds are part of that. And you know, like mapping out the general wind system of a valley or something like that, yeah. For example.
Well, if it has, as you say, that richness of it actually, there's also a project to mimic birds. And then what we're going to do as well is when we get the patterns of the movements, we're going to create a dance, you know, physical dance out of it and create some art out of it and some, you know, to make people more aware of birds and the way they move, and you know, so if it's an integrated effort, then it's got a story behind it that's more interesting.
Yeah,
it's one of the things that you know I like when Alex talks about his thinking and ideas. What I like is that you know, renewable energy isn't that sexy anymore. It's not that interesting. It's like okay, we've got it. You know, wind, water, whatever. But what is really interesting is the stories around it. So, for example, if you had a new type of school that was powered by totally by wind energy, that's a more interesting story than, you know, so it's richer. And if you have a story where you've got an entire island is converted because of wind energy, and then the stories, and you actually have a wind energy system that creates the energy to make the olives, for example, and then the olives are converted into, well, these are wind olives. And then there's a company based in olive oil, which is called Wind Olive Oil. You know, it becomes a more enriched, interesting story than just, hey, we're putting up some, you know, new energy systems. So what? No,
I totally agree.
Who cares?
I think it's sort of like bands. You've got a drummer, you've got a guitarist, you've got a singer, and they all have different things. But just to throw something in there, it's important to know that you need a band, yes, but it's also important to know that the harmonies of... And I'm not saying this to you personally. I'm just saying it as a general thing that I think people miss. Like what I'm saying basically is that people can say, oh, yeah, let's have five different kinds of people and put them in a room. And then because they're different kinds of people, it'll work. And it's like, no, just because somebody can drum doesn't mean, A, that they're good, and B, that they're going to click with the guitarist. And, you know, do you get what I'm trying to say? And there's this sort of and it's an interesting thing, because if you – it's very difficult, I think, to get a group of people and to formulate them into – you know, without being kind of dominating in terms of, okay, you do this and you do that. You know, it's difficult to get a sort of a total harmony of exactly all the elements you need to create like an orchestra or something. And it maybe is interesting actually in terms of how you guys are trying to do that, maybe to look at some creative organizations and how they do it. You know, like Cirque du Soleil or I don't know, some bands and sort of look at the ingredients and sort of explore what it is that makes one quartet work and one not. Do you get what I'm trying to say? It's that harmony between the different
notes. Yeah, I mean, that, you know, when I think of the people involved in a specific project, it's like many of them are exceptionally smart, and we go, yeah, fine, but we've got different priorities. We're trying to make money here. We're trying to do this. And others would say, well, this is exactly what's wrong with the company, so it needs to be done. That's it.
Right.
And it's and so when you've got a closed system, which it's sort of it's closed and it's bounded and limited by the people who are involved in it, and you know, I'm involved in this project, but I am talking to you. I'm talking to other people, I'm talking to many people, and I allow that information in. So if it comes up in conversation with this group, I would input what you just said. Because that's the way I am. But others I know in this group are not interacting with any more than two people a day.
Right. But that kind of works, I think, in, you know, in your role, maybe you could see yourself as sort of like a pollinator of thinking, and you know, you're helping to sort of try and understand everybody and to try and, you know, make sure that there's crossover and cross understanding between people and things like that, which is an essential role, like weaving.
Well, it only works. I'm only able to do that role if people see that that's what I'm doing, and they value it and they recognize it, which is they're not so.
It's a role, and it's something that, I mean, I've got some experience working with people who were doing that and encouraging them to do that or whatever, for example, within projects. And it's a very understated role, and it's a very appreciated role. But I had one little experience worth sharing that was an inspiration for me, because we went to some European Commission event to present something, and there was the organization of the European Commission and one department and all that. And the people who were actually organizing the event itself were one of the departments of the European Commission. And the head woman there, the woman who ran that particular unit, actually had a member of the team who was sort of her sidekick, was this really wonderful woman, and whose job it was to basically, you know, pollinate and to weave and to be social with people. And, you know, and we were really like pleasantly surprised that somebody at that level working within a, you know, high level government area had this, you know, kind of basically a weaver in her team. And it was a wonderful woman, and, you know, like a witch almost, like in a positive mm-hmm. sense, like a shaman or something, you know, somebody who.
So the EU, you know, employed her, and she was known as the weaver.
Well, I called her the weaver in my mind, but
what was her job title?
I don't know what her job title was, but I've got her on Facebook.
Okay,
still, so I could
find
out.
Please
write her and
put her in touch. I like to
chat.
Let's interview her.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea, actually. Yeah.
And
yeah,
I've
because,
got to go,
you know, that's the role
and also,
that you're.
Yeah, well, that's cool. And I've got to go now, because I've got to do the daddy thing. So.
Okay, cool. Well, good luck.
But that's another 20. That's another 20 minutes. That's there we go. Get more
nice one. I think
content.
This was a nice one, though.
Okay, so cool. Yeah, if you do that, just set her up and chat, and let's see if we can get her chatting. Also,
yeah, well,
Vicente.
Yeah, I'll contact her anyway. Just say hi and see how she is and all that, and then we'll.
Vicente's also the guy I met tonight. My friend. He's happy to be interviewed about the Internet of Things.
Great. Cool.
Okay.
Cool, man. So,
all right.
Just send these over when you're ready, and
we'll do.
Edit this one up.
All right, mate.
Nice one.
Good
Take
night.
Care, man.
Take care, and thanks for all your work with Susanna's computer.
Oh, you're welcome.
Pleasure. Okay.
Nice one.
Cool.
Take
Bye.
Care. Bye.